This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 9th of April 2012. Hello and welcome to the 26th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're going to be getting in the carnival spirit as we focus on the blossoming culture of Brazil. I'll be joined in the studio by Helena Gasparian, head of the cultural and academic sector for the Brazilian Embassy in the UK, and Alicia Bastos, founder of Braziality, a not-for-profit cross-cultural project showcasing Brazilian art.
The interest in Brazil has grown enormously in the past 2 years. It's obvious. Everybody's, you know, they want to know more about Brazil, they want to go to Brazil, they want to bring things over.
We'll also be hearing from the recent It's All True documentary film festival in São Paulo.
I think that in Brazil, music is a great cultural expression, and that we must do this kind of movies and create this document that show for young people what happened in that period.
And getting some views on Brazilian culture from artist Emmanuel Dimas de Melo Pimenta.
The moment you arrive in Brazil, you are a Brazilian. It's amazing, it's fantastic. Because of this, so many people love Brazil.
Plus a minute of sound from our resident Brazilian, a visit to La Revue 21 in Paris, and Belarus's only contemporary art gallery. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But before all that, and to set the tone, let's have a bit of Brazilian music. This is Malu Magalhães with Vela Eluca.
Pode falar que eu não ligo agora, amigo. Eu tô em outra. Eu tô ficando velha. Eu tô ficando doida.
That was Brazilian artist Malu Magalhães with Vela Eluca, setting the tone for our Brazilian focus today. And to talk about Brazilian culture, I'm joined in the studio by Helena Gasparian, head of the cultural and academic sector for the Brazilian Embassy in the UK, and Alicia Bastos, founder and artistic managing director of Braziality, a not-for-profit cross-cultural project showcasing art by Brazilian artists and international artists inspired by Brazil. That's quite a mouthful. That's out the way, but it's easier than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's a bit easier than that. I wanted to ask you both, actually, their grand titles, and they're obviously august institutions, one not-for-profit, one part of the Brazilian government. But Brazil must be an easy sell. Your jobs, come on. People must be queuing around the block to do what you do.
From here, from London, it's not that easy because Brazil is quite far away from here. And, and the logistics of bringing things over to here is very difficult. On the other hand, the welcoming of people here, the curiosity, the interest, people will go the extra mile to have something from Brazil in on their premises. So it's really very gratifying.
And Alicia, not for profit. Sometimes they're tough places to work, especially cultural ones in the UK and across Europe. People are cutting back. The UK's kind of always had a history of sort of reacting against these cuts. But in Brazil, it's a booming economy. A not for profit must be a great place to work, presumably.
Well, the most interesting thing is to have everybody is really curious about Brazilian art. And within the rising of the economy, there's a lot of artists that go and travel, they go and stay and live in different countries. And Braziality is about this, and to organize a network of artists that live abroad. And it's a very interesting moment for all of us in terms of mixing our culture within the international art scene and being very welcome. So it is not very easy, but it is very exciting.
Okay, yeah, because I guess that for both of you, there's goodwill. We said, you know, there's a lot of goodwill towards Brazil. People, as you say, people are curious about it. But do you think it's a tough thing when people always have possibly a view of Brazil? People think that, you know, Brazil's always sunny, happy, shiny, beaches and all the rest of it. That's a horrible bit of a stereotype. There's clearly a lot of problems in Brazil, and there's artists and projects that obviously are tackling that as well. Alicia?
There are a lot of challenges, and there are a lot of improvement to be done in the sense of the Brazilian artist to be prepared to enter the international artscape. So, meaning that...
Did you say artscape? Artscape. I love artscape. It's a brand new word.
Like
it's a brand new word.
I call it artscape.
We've minted it on the culture show.
So I found it very helpful to have organizations like the embassy and, for instance, Brasiliality to sort of help them to enter, you know, the other arts organizations internationally and residencies and be prepared and be doing courses. So all this makes it much more worth it. I think it's a growth of the quality of Brazilian artworks. We always had incredible artists and the best of them have been working all over the world. And now we just have a bigger range of emerging artists that are conquering, you know, the space, which is really interesting. I think it helps a lot to our, you know, cultural mm-hmm. movement around the world.
And Helena, do you find you're busier? You're part of the embassy. You're part of the diplomatic work of Brazil. It's gotten easier now that people know that it's a booming economy or it's a growing economy. The cultural stuff sort of slots into place with your help.
Certainly, you know, the interest in Brazil has grown enormously in the past 2 years. It's obvious. Everybody's, you know, they want to know more about Brazil. They want to go to Brazil. They want to bring things over. That said, we also have budget cuts, quite radical ones. So it's not all that easy to bring over, because it's expensive, all the things you want to bring. But we're getting a sort of mix of very popular art as a way of changing life. We have Afro Reggae, which is a very traditional organization that works in favelas to get people off crime, off traffic, and they have roots here in England. So they come over, you know, once a year. They're going to the Salisbury Festival, which is themed on Brazil this uh-huh. year, so which is nice. And we've got classical music, very good classical music. We've got popular music. This is a year where we are bringing... Gilberto Gil will be over here for a long time. Uh-huh. He's bringing Back to Black, which is a festival, 3-day festival on the African roots of our culture as a country. And it's coming here to Billingsgate. It's going to be massive, wonderful, with lots of African artists as well. And Gilberto Gil, the 3 days. So it's easier in the sense that, you know, we have so many things to show. We have the problems, we have the solutions, if you want.
They've got the problems and the solutions.
We don't have to sell all that much money anyway. But, you know, you can't have everything. So no, it's
an interesting
thing.
I mean, I wonder, you're obviously channeling the work of artists, musicians, and all sorts of different people into these projects. Is the sort of success of a culture when you no longer have to sort of do that? Yeah. When art fairs spring up, when record labels spring up, when there are global, you know, pop groups or artists that are famous and they sort of take care of itself. Do you feel that the international focus of Brazilian culture is sort of in its infancy still at the moment, that you can kind of control it and see where it goes?
You cannot control it, but I think you have to sort of shepherd it in a sense that you have so many things that you have in Brazil that nobody has an inkling of. For instance, V&A is going to show in August an artist called Arthur Bispo do Rosário, who was a schizophrenic, lived for 50 years in an institution and created the most amazing, amazing work of, you know, massive work. He was barely literate. But the director of the institution was a Carl Jung student. She knew him, she corresponded with him. And instead of electric shocks or lobotomy, she created this art place inside the institution, and it boomed. And nobody knows about it.
Well, this is the sort of thing, isn't it? Because I think that's the thing we talked about right at the beginning, is sort of getting away from the stereotype of Brazil, right? Yeah. And this must be something that you both have to work with, Alicia. Yeah. It's that sort of thing of you must be itching to tell the world about an underground of if we take art, if we just take painting, you know, for one, there must be such a sort of rich underground of stuff that you want to tell people about.
And for example, last year we did an event on street art, not meaning only graffiti art, which is absolutely huge in Brazil at the moment. São Paulo is probably the capital of graffiti art all over the world. We had the first international biennial with, you know, almost 100 artists involved. Thousands of people came to see. And the underground art in Brazil, I can't even call it underground because for the it was the first time it was now we passed the law. And now in Brazil you're allowed to do, it's not a criminal action anymore to do a graffiti artwork.
Really?
Yes.
What, so is there a line between graffiti and graffiti tagging artwork?
There is, yes. This is the discussion.
Yeah, this is the biggest discussion. But I think it's
I'll be
healthy.
Checking your handbag on the way out for spray cans because there's some rude daubings.
Absolutely. No, I'll call some friends to do the work much better than I do.
Where's the line? How does it work?
Well, tagging where they just, you know, write their names without any artistic, you know, input. It's not art.
Okay.
But there are some murals that are absolutely gobsmacking. Yeah. You know, you would spend in front of an artwork of that, you know, it causes inside myself the same thing that Dali does. Mm-hmm. You know, you will look at it and you go, my God. And it's a very political way of expressing themselves as well. It has a lot of opinion behind. So I particularly think that the street art in Brazil is massive. But the other kind of thing like theatre, street theatre, you know, Boal, which is a style of social theatre that you go into communities and you pick a subject. And within an artwork of which is very interactive, you basically involve the community into an art piece. Mm-hmm. And this is fantastic. It's a model that's been spreading. We have followers of Boal all over the world now. And
this is sort of like an idea, I guess, of Brazilian society, of street, of living, you know, living very much half your life in your house and half your life on the street. Your street is your living room because of the temperature, and maybe because of the climate and the way that the culture works. And that's a funny thing. How exportable do you think that is to cold old Northern Europe, ladies?
I think it, you know, it's a sort of a marriage of opposites. Uh-huh. There's this fascination for Brazil, for, you know, the mass of people on the streets, and it's true. For instance, the biggest gay parade in the world is in São Paulo. Mm-hmm. The last time it ran, it was about 3 million people on the street of São Paulo. And it's a party, you know, it's a sort of, there's no violence whatsoever involved in this big happenings. We're very good at that. On the other hand, there is this fascination from our artists with the scene here in Europe, the professionalism, the fact that you can live from what you earn from art alone, which is not always the case in Brazil. So it's a sort of complement, one on the other, I think. It's important to say that people make culture in Brazil without being highbrow. You have this popular culture, which is very vibrant, very much alive, and very much a part of the day-to-day life of everybody, except of certainly of urban populations. So you don't, it's not something you see everywhere, but, you know, you'll have music, you'll have dance, you'll have things happening in your neighborhood every weekend.
And what sort of people turn up? Is it just anyone? Anyone wanders
just
across and has
turn
a
up,
point?
Yeah, yes. It's not something state organized. It's not something, it's commercial even, but it's something that, you know, attracts millions of people. So this sort of popular culture, popular climate is very strong.
All right. Well, hopefully our listeners have got a nice understanding of a country that has a burgeoning artistic scene. And even if some of the theatres are the streets themselves, and even if some of the galleries are the ends of the blocks. Mm-hmm. Alicia Bastos, founder and artistic managing director of Braziliality, and Helena Gasparian, head of the cultural and academic sector of the Brazilian Embassy in the UK. Dobrigan. Well, carrying on the Brazilian cultural theme, next we explore the truth behind Brazil's film scene with the annual It's All True documentary film festival. It's currently making its rounds in four Brazilian cities, with the biggest showing happening last week in Brazil's largest city, São Paulo. It's the same place where the festival began 17 years ago. Monocle reporter Sheena Rossiter was there to meet the promoter and directors, check out some films, and to talk about where the documentary genre is headed.
Filmgoers slowly trickle in the Cine Sesc Theater on Sao Paulo's trendy street, Rua Augusta. It's opening night of the Etude de Verdade Film Festival, It's All True in English, and these film fanatics are filling the theater to get a dose of reality. But about 20 years ago, this scene was uncommon in Brazil. Even though the nation has a history of documenting reality through film, before Etude de Verdade started 17 years ago, there was no real outlet to watch documentaries. The festival's founder, Amir Labaki, explains.
As we have a very strong tradition of documentary production, it was a bit odd for us that we were doing docs, but we were not watching docs. And then when I started in 1995, we had two Brazilian docs open in theaters and one international doc. And last year, in 2011, we had 40 Brazilian docs and almost 20 international docs. Then the scene has changed a lot.
And after 4 months of sifting through and viewing around 1,200 entries, a total of 80 films are being shown here in Sao Paulo in the international and Brazilian competitions, along with special screenings. Thanks to a Brazilian law that allows big companies to get tax breaks if they invest some money into culture, this festival is 100% free. And this year, Brazilian docs are depicting stronger true stories than ever, with the festival's two opening films being Brazilian productions. Unlike before, says Amir.
We decided to have two Brazilian docs as opening films. Normally we have one Brazilian and one international. Two of them are dealing with the Brazilian cultural scene in the late 60s, beginning of the 70s.
One of the opening docs is Tropicália. The film's director, Marcelo Machado, tells what it's about.
Tropicália is a music movement that occurred in Brazil during the late 60s. I mean, it's not just music, it's about the whole culture and arts. This was a very hard period in Brazil because we came from the military coup and we went to a very hard period of censorship. These musicians, they were expressing themselves exactly when this censorship started.
Made purely from archive material and stock footage, and combined with innovative animation techniques and motion graphics, Tropicália takes viewers through the height of the movement between 1967 and 1969, documenting the good that came out of a bad time. The rich sounds of music and the bursting cultural scene were severely repressed by Brazil's military regime. Several of the artists were arrested and tortured, and two of the leading musicians of the movement, Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, were even forced into exile because of their freedom of expression and independent thought. Even though he was only a child at the time, director Marcelo Machado was, and still is, touched by the Tropicália movement. He explains why he decided to make the documentary, which was no easy task.
Tropicália is a big influence in my childhood. Even today, Caetano, Gil, and these musicians, I'm a big fan of them. And I realized that we didn't have a documentary about this period. I think that in Brazil, music is a great cultural expression and that we must do this kind of movies and create this document that show for young people what happened in that period.
On the international side of things, the Oscar-winning documentary short, Saving Face, had a special screening. The emotional, heart-wrenching film takes viewers through the personal experience of acid attack victims in Pakistan, mostly women who were burnt by their husbands.
That's the only reason anyone is interested in me is because I was married to Neil Cassidy and lover of Jack Kerouac.
The The Swedish maid, Love Always Carolyn, teaches Brazilians here about the American beetroot generation as we hear the story of Carolyn Cassidy, the former wife of Neil Cassidy and the lover of Jack Kerouac. But as the years go by and Ed Tudo Verdade continues to grow, what is starting to make the festival interesting is the evolution of the genre itself. With platforms like Vimeo and YouTube available online, and with high-quality recording equipment more affordable, it seems like everyone these days can be a documentary filmmaker. As Marcelo Bauer, the founder of Brazilian site Web Documentaries, explains at one of the festival's debates, this year the festival is seeing more user-generated docs.
They have some examples here, some documentaries that started on the web and now are on the screen of the cinemas. For example, they have one documentary here called Crisis from Greece that started on the web with a group of documentaries relating what they have in terms of economic crisis there. And the videos were published on the web, and now they have one version to be exhibited on the festivals, and it's showing here. It's a very interesting way that shows that we can start something from the web and go to the movies after that.
And he thinks that this trend of web to the big screen is a trend that will continue in the coming years at Etudo Verdade.
It's a very interesting moment to start making movies, because we have new kind of opportunities with the interaction that the internet brings to you. And I think from the future we'll have very different ways to access the public. And the public will participate more on the movies. Interactive documentaries. Documentaries that, besides the video itself, can interact more with people, people sharing contents, people interacting with interface and having access to different kind of contents, like text is integrated with the video. So a lot of things that you can put besides the video itself on the web that, of course, you can't put on the movies.
It's All True founder Amir agrees with Marcelo that the genre is still very much alive and will continue to grow. But even though everyone can have a camera, not everyone can make a film.
I think documentary is alive and kicking, and it's probably stronger today than it was in the ever. And I absolutely agree with Ricky Leacock, who died last year. He told me 10 years ago, he was making a comparison between a violin and a digital camera. And he said, take a look at the violin. It's not a good deal. You have the body, the bow. It's quite simple. Try to make art from that. It's the same thing, and he was telling, it's the same thing with the camera. More people can afford a camera. It's great, it's quite simple now. But you need an artist to really do a film.
And with queues wrapping around the block to get in to catch a glimpse of the latest documentaries coming from Brazil and abroad, it's clear that documentaries have a vibrant home here in Brazil. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with more from Brazil after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24, where today we're talking about Brazil. Emmanuel Pimenta is an intermedia artist who was born in Brazil and now lives between Switzerland and America. He pioneered the concept of virtual architecture, has collaborated with contemporary musical luminaries like John Cage, and holds exhibitions around the world. Frederick Bernas caught up with Pimenta in New York and started by asking if there's any underlying concept that holds together his diverse body of work.
What I do is to work with brain systems and to change in some way your way of thought. Because only with difference we have consciousness. I work with neurology, cognition, perception, and to creation of logical traps. So that is to say, when I'm dealing with time is music when I'm dealing with space is architecture. Space is a trip in time.
So it's the idea that you want to try and make people think differently when they encounter your work.
I never try, I do. For example, if you listen to a music of mine, a composition, there is something strange there. This something strange is a difference, is a break in the logical process. This is my, basically is my work, and it can happen on architecture or music or even photography and so on. But I don't make many things. Apparently it's lots of things, but they are very focused.
And so how would you describe yourself in a word? Mm-hmm. A scientist?
In a certain sense, they are connected, they are linked. And I work, in fact, you are right, I work with art and science. So a part of mine is scientist, or another part is an artist. But, you know, I have a method. I am a very disciplined guy. You know? So when I have, for example, a composition or architectural project, I have a structure to develop, and so it's a method. Maybe in this sense, more scientist than artist.
And how do you use technology in your work?
I was always very attached to computers. I started working with computers in 74, 73. In the early 1980s, I created the concept of virtual architecture. The concept of virtual architecture is a method to think and to design space. So we have some principles underlining this method. One of them is that all space is time, is design of time, and it's very complex. So you should use complexity to understand and to create and to design it. For example, if you have a space to be created in a certain place, you need to know the flux of people, wind, sun, water, electricity, culture, information, everything. This is one of the elements. But there is another one, for example, the programmability. What this means to create a space that can be changed in its use.
How do you think Brazilian culture translates to other countries?
You know, I don't know if my perception is precise, is good. But Brazil has one thing that I think that's amazing. It's wonderful. The moment you arrive in Brazil, you are a Brazilian. It's amazing. It's fantastic. Because of this, so many people love Brazil. You arrive there and you are integrated automatically. There is no, for example, in the United States, Canada, anywhere, even in Mexico, anywhere you go, you are foreign. There are no foreigners in Brazil. So Brazil has this quality of informality that turns possible to make things sometimes unexpected. The problem of Brazil, in my point of view, is that it is too closed in cultural terms. What people know about Brazil in general is about carnival and parties and things like that. But the cultural side of Brazil is not well known. I give you one example. In the 40s and 50s, for example, Brazil had a great writer called Guimarães Rosa that was similar to James Joyce. No one else. The largest collection of Renoir in the world is in São Paulo. The largest collection of Kandinsky of the world is in São Paulo. Maybe we have the largest collection also of Mondrian in São Paulo. No one knows about that. It's a secret. I suggest to the listeners to make some research on the culture of Brazil. They will be very surprised.
And so do you think that maybe as Brazil begins to establish itself as more of an economic force, that the cultural element will grow with that?
Culture is fundamental. A country to be great, big, it's fundamental to have a strong culture, a powerful art. You know, one thing that the American people developed with a great success, when you have an opening here in New York, for example, who pays for this opening? In general, there are companies. Why? Because it's a meeting point to make new business. And so this sensitivity to the culture is very, very important, because business also is part of the culture. You know? It's important to meet people and to exchange things and so on. But Brazil is a huge potential.
That was Emmanuel Dimas de Melo Pimenta talking with Frederick Bernas. Still to come in part two, we'll be indulging in a bit more Brazilian music before heading to Paris to meet one of the founders of Revue 21. We'll visit Belarus's only independent contemporary art gallery and enjoy a minute of sound from our resident Brazilian, Copacabana. But before all that, let's have some more Brazilian music. This is Tie with Na Varanda de Lie. That was Tie with Na Varanda da Lie, and you're listening to Culture with me, Rob Bounce, on Monocle 24. Time for a fix of media, and today we're off to Paris, where Alexander Orne went to meet Patrick de Saint-Exupéry, one of the two founders of Revue 21. Launched in 2008 with no advertising and limited online content, this magazine is dedicated to long-form journalism, a beautifully crafted publication only sold in bookshops. In 2011, the Revue team launched a new magazine called Six Mois, a biannual publication of 350 pages devoted to photojournalism. With the first edition selling even better than the original magazine, plans are underway for international expansion.
You have had a long career as a foreign correspondent. How did you come to create 21?
Well, I was just in a way sort of tired of the way I was working. I was working as a reporter for a Daily News, and I just feel at a point there was something else to try. Everything was more and more technical, very formatted, and I want to just to do something else, think differently, but still being on the news, on the information. But I got that feeling, which was very strong, and then I decided to try it. That's very simple.
Looking at your past experiences, how did it all come together? How does it all come together in a magazine like 21?
Laurent Beccaria, who is a publisher, and I decided to mix our both experiences on a very simple contract. Try to assemble the best of publishing with the best of journalism. And then that was the basis of 21. It took us around 1 year to elaborate everything and to go up to the first issue. What we wanted to do was very simple, going back to narrative. Just forget everything about all that virtual world who is around us more and more. Just go back to narrative, to the reality of the things. Don't think about the world, just tell the story of the world. That's the basic contract. And 5 years later, we didn't make any change up to that. And our willingness is to go every time deeper, deeper, deeper.
How would you describe 21 in just a few words?
Frankly speaking, I would just have one word, a window on the world. Just open the window and look at the world, the real world around you, the one sometimes you did not have any time to catch it. 21 is just opening the window to the real world.
When you start thinking about the next issues, how do you think about the reports, the stories you want to include?
I don't know. I can't be more frank. I don't know. It's like a cooker. You're just doing things. And you don't know why at a point you decided to add that to that. You just feel it could be good, and you're always doing that sort of mixture. But there is no recipe.
As many announced the death of print journalism, 21 has fared pretty well, actually very well since its launch. What made it success, do you think?
It's very easy. And that's our feeling. 21 is post-internet, after internet time. The proposition is so different. It's print? Okay, yes, sure. It's paper? Sure, yeah. But the paper is a future of the internet. We're convinced of that.
How can a publication be successful with a limited online presence today?
That's exactly what I was saying. We're convinced. We're post-internet. Internet is very useful. We use internet every day, but it's impossible to imagine internet as an endpoint. It's a tool, and it's such a nice tool, but it's only a tool.
21 is halfway between a magazine and a book. It's sold only in bookshops, has no advertising, and limited online presence. What do you think people are really looking for?
I don't know, and I will add to what you just said. We don't make any advertising too. There have never been advertising campaign for 21, not a single word. All is in the curiosity. Everyone has a lot of curiosity. The problem is to open the window and the door and to explain and to be truly convincing when you think, wow, the world needs to be written. It's so fantastic. The world is going on in such a fantastic way. Let's tell that story. And this is curiosity. And this is the only resort. But that resort, there are so much energy in that thirst. This is incredible. And it's so better than marketing and all that stuff.
What were and remain the challenges for a publication like 21?
21 is now a five-year story. When the first issue was published, it was like the door was closed. Everyone was telling us, well, in a very sympathetic way, but was telling us sorts of things like, okay, guys, you're very sympathetic, but you're a bit crazy. It's not going to work. Now, 5 years later, what do we see when going back on the way that have been done? We did create a market. We have now in France something like between 15 and 20 print publication on the model of 21. And you'll see all these publications in the bookshops on tables. So we did create a market, that's obvious. But it's not so easy because it's not a question of a modelization. We see all the people are trying just to say, well, it's a 3 months publication in bookshops, the price is €15, and then they try to just to copy it. Well, it's okay, no problem. But they just forgot a thing. You need the envy. You need the creation. And if you forgot the creation, it could work for a time, but it's going to stop at a point.
You recently created a new magazine called 6 Month. What's next? Is there something else you want to do?
A lot.
And what?
A lot. This is life, you know. You just make one step, and then it gives you some ideas, and then you make a further step, and you see, and you take your time. You're very pragmatic. But you know, there is so much to do. Just take the time to think about and then jump.
That was Patrick de Saint-Exupéry, one of the two founders of Revue 21. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Belarus, woof, after this.
For the latest Monocle news, previews of upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop on all our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com. Let's stay in touch.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. If you hear about Belarus at all these days, it's usually bad news about the way President Alexander Lukashenko is treating his people. In the country widely known as the last dictatorship in Europe, freedom of speech is severely limited. And if you hear anything about Belarusian culture, it's most likely to be about the underground Belarus Free Theatre, which tours Europe and the US and is something of a militant project. But with little sign of political change on the horizon, others inside Belarus are striving to keep culture alive within the boundaries of the dictatorship. Minsk's Galleria U is one such institution, a gallery, bookshop and cafe. It shows off the work of contemporary Belarusian artists. Correspondent Gulliver Cragg visited a show there with art director Antonia Slabodchikova.
Located in a former bottle recycling centre at the back of a courtyard, Minsk's only independent gallery of contemporary art is in the heart of the city, but not visible from the street. I've come to meet the gallery's art director Anna Chistosierdova in the gallery's cafe.
You say that you want this gallery to be not political, apolitical. How do you stay apolitical and independent in a situation such as Belarus?
For us, we have only one policy, it's a cultural policy. In fact, we try to present a new generation of Belarusian art. Usually, these artists have no possibility to present their project in official places like museums or state galleries. That is why maybe sometimes when people are speaking about our gallery, they are preferred to speak that we are like oppositional gallery. But for us, it's our opposition for academic art, for traditional art, because in fact in Belarus we had a lot of interesting people, but nobody knows about it because they have no presentations in the big festivals, on the big Republic exhibitions of contemporary art. That is why our idea to promote a new Belarusian culture and also promote Belarusian language.
Using the Belarusian language in Belarus is often associated with being in the opposition.
Yeah. You know, but for me it's a little bit stupid because in fact I think that the best example how we try to change the situation with the language to start to speak in on this language. You know, when you are coming to the galleries in Ukraine and Lithuania, usually you have all information on the native languages. That is why it was a little bit stupid in Belarus, because when people come to our country, they usually didn't understand what the people are living here, because everybody is speaking in Russian.
And does the fact that you don't want to be political in any way mean that you sometimes have to refuse artists who have political works?
Yeah, you know, we are not directors of artists, and when somebody wants to create something about political question, about social problems, yes, they can and they should do it.
And they can show it here?
Why not? But when it's only political project, maybe it's not interesting for us, because for us it's more interesting to have some discussing about new type of arts, about new themes in Belarusian art, and sometimes, some projects about politics. But in fact, I don't think that in Belarus we have a strong political art and strong way of this kind of art.
And yet,
why they prefer to reflect about maybe some social question, maybe about I don't know, life relations, about death, about future, and about nothing. You know, nothing. It's also the big word for Belarus.
Why?
I don't know. Usually, when we have some discussing, it will be great to have something, blah blah blah. But we have no in Belarus, it's nothing. And for us, one of our loveliest work of one of our artists, Alexey Lunyov, it's a work with name Nichogo Nyama. It's in Belarusian language. It's nothing to have. It's like zero, total zero.
Okay, so tell me about this exhibition.
Antonina Slobodchikova is, I think, 35 years old. She's a Belarusian artist. She studied in Academy of Arts. And mostly active, she works last, I think, 5-6 years. This exposition includes two spaces. One is a white hall and the second one is a dark hall. In white hall, we had something like 100 images. Collage works was made by Antonina. Also, it includes a special video and installation with the name of this project, Я но тут.
This was a performance, I guess.
Yeah, it was a performance near Minsk in her summer house and village. It was Burn, this name of this exhibition, Я но тут in Belarusian language. It's It Here. It Here in English. It's Here, yeah. And it's a reflection about feelings of scary. You know, this feeling, it's hard to explain and hard to find a special word for this feeling. And in this project, it was something like reflection and fighting with her scaries and dangerous and these feelings.
That was art director Antonia Slobodchikova from the Galleria U in Belarus, talking to Gulliver Cragg. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. Time now for the glorious 1 minute of sound. And to continue on the theme today, it's the turn of Monocle's resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He got a bit creative with his motherland, and here's what he came up with.
Brazilian style. Gisele. Pelé. Oscar Niemeyer. Sugarloaf.
Balançado é mais Roberto Carlos. É a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, porque estou tão sozinho. Ah, porque tudo é tão triste.
Carinho.
Ah,
mãos. Risada.
Sorriso.
Inconstitucional.
Constitucional.
Constanza Pascolato.
Fashion.
Amor.
Você manda um beijo pra avó dela, que foi amicíssima de vovó. Quando vovó morava na
Europa. Meu bem, eu estou viajando acompanhada. Você reserva pra mim a suíte presidencial?
Mosaics. Conrado Secreto. Pink Dolphins.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bill Burr, helped enormously by Tom Hall, Nina Akbar, Holly Fisher, Ricardo Moreno, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Time for one final song this week to finish our Brazilian theme. This is My Dirty Fingers with Cousins. Thanks for tuning in.